that Biden belongs to, that, you know, NATO will come back onto the table, and the transatlantic partnership, as Angela Merkel put it, will return to some degree of normality as the European center sees it.
We want to thank you so much, Priya Gopal, professor at University of Cambridge, author of Insurgent Empire, Anti-Colonial Resistance and British Descent. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Reith Abdulahad in Turkey, to Maria Luisa Mendonça, speaking about Brazil, and Kumi Naidoo in South Africa. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Ya no pienso mantener este cariño.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO is excited to be part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives you a little back in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies. Available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. And thanks.
There's so much that we need to share, so send a smile and show you care.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon shatters its single-day record for new COVID-19 infections, surpassing 1,000 for the first time since the pandemic began. A University of Washington legal expert takes a critical look at the evidence in President Trump's voter fraud claims. And surveys show a majority of Americans say their stress levels are much higher because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 12, 2020. I'm Annette Newell. For the first time, Oregon has exceeded 1,000 new COVID-19 cases in a single day. The Oregon Health Authority has reported 1,122 new confirmed and presumptive infections as of this morning. This brings the state's total to almost 54,000 infected. Today's total is the highest number of cases reported in a single day since the pandemic started in Oregon. Small social gatherings keep spreading the disease. For example, health experts trace this week's rising cases to at least 5 Halloween events. The Oregon Health Authority is urging people to limit social gatherings to their households, reduce the frequency of social gatherings, and keep the same 6 people in your social circle. Throughout Oregon, several hospitals are postponing elective surgeries as they expect COVID-19 surges. Health officials say they're bracing for the darkest months of the pandemic, citing flu season and looming winter weather. Legacy Health, Kaiser Permanente, and Oregon Health and Sciences University have all voluntarily decided to set limits on elective surgeries, freeing up space, funds, and staffing to help manage potentially overwhelming caseloads of COVID-19. The state's 2 other major health systems, Providence and Peace Health, have not announced they're limiting surgeries. Day surgeries and outpatient procedures will not be affected. But examples of surgeries that might be postponed include knee and hip replacements. Despite recent COVID surges, hospitals along the coastal regions and in the greater metro area say ICU beds are still readily available. But grim predictions point to capacity being reached by mid-December if cases keep climbing. Right now, there are 290 hospitalizations due to the virus in Oregon. President-elect Joe Biden leads by about 45,000 votes in Pennsylvania, one of several states where President Trump is challenging election results in court. Now, as Eric Tegedoff reports, a University of Washington law expert says evidence is lacking in Trump's voter fraud claims.
The Trump campaign is challenging the results of the election in court, but so far is coming up short in proving allegations of voter fraud. Trump has lawsuits in a handful of states. In Pennsylvania, his campaign won a small victory in state court, ruling that officials must segregate a small number of mail-in ballots in case the Secretary of State's extended deadline to receive them is found unconstitutional. But Lisa Mannheim at the University of Washington School of Law says she's seen no evidence of fraud that could change the election outcome.
Voter fraud is a serious allegation, and it needs to be backed up with actual evidence. And it's that evidence that we are just not seeing any degree of in an amount that could possibly overturn the result of the election.
Mannheim notes even if the extended deadline in Pennsylvania is ruled unconstitutional, the court wouldn't decide to overturn the outcome of the vote. Instead, it would adjust the count by the number of ballots identified in the lawsuit. President-elect Joe Biden's lead is more than 45,000 votes in the Keystone State. This week, U.S. Attorney General William Barr authorized the Department of Justice to investigate voter fraud claims. Mannheim says Barr can do that under the law, as long as the DOJ investigates credible allegations.
If DOJ goes further than that, the question becomes not only a legal one, but a question of what message the Department of Justice is sending.
And Mannheim says in his role as president, Trump is mostly a bystander when it comes to legal challenges to election results.
The law gives a sitting president essentially no legal role to play at all in the resolution of an election. As a candidate, a sitting president is able to file lawsuits, but that's true of any candidate.
She adds that this isn't the first and won't be the last disputed election. But Mannheim notes Trump's claims of a stolen election aren't normal.
Disputed elections are pretty common, and that's why we have well-established legal procedures in place to resolve those disputes. What is not common about what's going on, what is actually unusual about this election, is the rhetoric.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Some Oregon Republican leaders have not yet acknowledged Joe Biden as president-elect. Despite the numbers showing a Biden victory from electoral votes in key swing states by last Saturday, key members of the Oregon Republican Party are joining President Trump in contesting the election results. In a news release entitled Stop the Steal, Oregon GOP Chairman Bill Currier said, quote, "We condemn the intentional lack of safeguards, covert counting of illegal ballots, and suspicious vote tallies in Democratic-led states." Currier calls the nationwide voting protocols for 2020 rapid, sloppy, and deeply flawed. He denounced the accuracy of mail-in votes while not directly commenting on Oregon's final voter tally. Oregon Republican State Senator Brian Boquist tweeted, quote, "The state-run media called the election when there are plenty of interesting things to say in some hotly contested states." And State Representative E. Werner Reschke also commented, quote, "The media is lying to you by saying Biden has already won." As the Trump campaign launches multiple lawsuits trying to contest the election results, they've been unsuccessful so far. But as Suzanne Potter reports, even though they're very unlikely to overturn the election, experts say the efforts could seriously impede the transition.
Members of the National Task Force on Election Crises are speaking out about President Donald Trump's refusal to concede the election, saying it could have major repercussions if it continues. The head of the General Services Administration is holding up almost $10 million for the Biden-Harris transition. Kate Shaw, a professor at the Cardozo School of Law, says she expects the voter fraud lawsuits launched by the Trump campaign to fail.
It is very difficult for me to see the GSA administrator defensively continuing to decline to make this determination, which does, I think, very much hinder the transition team.
All federal agencies have briefing books and a transition team in place, but it is unclear if they will be allowed to cooperate with Biden staffers before the lawsuits are resolved. Benita Gupta with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights sees President Trump's tweets as a part of a disinformation campaign to sow distrust.
it can make it more difficult in the future to have buy-in on a common agenda than in this moment of a global pandemic that could actually risk American lives.
Just before the election, President Trump issued an executive order making it easier to fire civil servants without cause. Norm Ornstein with the American Enterprise Institute warns the outgoing president could use the new powers to wreak havoc.
If you use it on a whole bunch of people in the infectious disease area at CDC and FDA, not to mention Anthony Fauci or Deborah Birx, it will make the next couple of months where the pandemic is on the rise much, much more difficult.
Ornstein also worries that the president will pardon staffers who destroyed records, such as presidential communications with foreign leaders, files on the child separation policy at the southern border, and government contracts.
I'm particularly concerned about the preservation of records for people who are going to want to cover their tracks, both for potential criminal culpability, but also embarrassment.
The task force is urging Congress to pass House Resolution 1, a package of democracy reforms. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A hand recount of all Georgia ballots is now underway. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger announced the state will conduct a full hand recount and audit of all paper ballots cast in last week's election. By Georgia's election laws, the count needs to be complete by the certification deadline of November 20th. Audits in Georgia are typically conducted by scanning a significant sample size of the total votes, and recounts are never done by hand. But the Secretary of State says a total manual recount will, quote, help build confidence in the election results and ensure electronic systems are functioning properly. The Secretary of State faced pressure from the Trump campaign this week, as well as from Georgia's Republican senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, who called for his resignation, claiming the election was neither honest nor transparent. They provided no evidence of fraud to support their claims. President-elect Joe Biden leads Donald Trump by more than 14,000 votes after the initial count. Election officials say they expect it will take a lot of people working overtime to meet that November 20th deadline. With almost 5 million votes cast in Georgia this year, election officials working in pairs need to count 23,000 votes per hour in front of legal observers from both parties to complete the count in time. This may not be the only recount Georgia sees this election cycle. Once results are certified, the state's election laws allow for a scanned recount of votes if the margin between the candidates is less than 0.5%. The margin after the initial count is 0.3% in favor of Joe Biden. A study by the nonpartisan group Fair Vote, looking into 31 recounts in the past 20 years, found most resulted in the winner gaining a fraction of a percent rather than losing significant ground. Even without Georgia's 16 electoral votes, Joe Biden still has more than the 270 required electoral votes to win the presidency. President Trump continues to dispute the results this week, refusing to concede defeat, even as world leaders reached out to congratulate President-elect Biden on his victory. Progressive groups are recommending candidates for cabinet and other top government positions. With more in the story, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
The Trump campaign continues to file lawsuits in states they lost by close margins. Yesterday, it was Michigan. So far, the cases have been largely dismissed for lack of evidence. But the president and his allies' baseless claims of fraud, both before and after the election, have consequences. Recent polling from The Economist and YouGov shows more than 8 in 10 Trump voters don't trust the result. That hurts America in many ways, says Julia Helwig, professor at the University of South Dakota.
We need to be a legitimate democracy that other countries can look up to and that our allies can feel good about. And so the implications are extraordinarily widespread.
Beyond the global repercussions, Helwig says the rhetoric can lead to more discord throughout the country. Yesterday, to honor Veterans Day, Trump went to Arlington National Cemetery in D.C. Biden paid his respects at the Philadelphia Korean War Memorial. The Biden transition team announced their future White House chief of staff, Ron Klain, a veteran Democratic operative who once served as one of Biden's top Senate aides. And two prominent progressive groups gave their recommendations for cabinet and other top government positions, suggesting Senators Bernie Sanders for the Labor Department and Elizabeth Warren for Treasury. Along with Justice Democrats, the Sunrise Movement is pushing for a cabinet-level office to address climate change. Here's Sunrise Movement's John Paul Mejia.
Now that we've got him elected, he has to do everything in his power to address this crisis starting on day one.
While Biden hasn't embraced the full Green New Deal, Mejia says these measures are a move in the right direction.
We are, not like overjoyed and celebrating victory and saying, hooray, right now, the work is over. But we have something to work with now, and we have more abilities to leverage power where it's necessary under a Biden administration.
I'm Lily Bulkey.
A Forest Grove family was disturbed on Halloween and not by trick-or-treaters. The culprit appears to be an off-duty local police officer who is facing charges. Forest Grove Officer Stephen Teets is cited for second-degree criminal trespass, accused of entering Morella Castaneda's driveway, verbally assaulting her, and then punching and kicking the garage entrance door to her household, yelling offensive language, and challenging the residents to fight. Early morning on October 31st, car alarms went off. Castaneda and her spouse went out to look, but didn't find a cause. When car alarm sounded a second time, Castaneda spotted Teets kicking a BLM sign before approaching her, prompting her to slam the door shut and call 911. Nearby, Forest Grove police caught the fleeing intruder, recognizing him as one of their own, and they drove him to his home. When police responded to Castaneda's emergency call, they did not tell her they detained a suspect and asked if any of her neighbors might be able to identify the intruder. The Washington County Sheriff's Office took over the case and revealed days later who the intruder was and that he's with the Forest Grove Police. They say he was not arrested because of COVID-19 restrictions, but Teets is off the streets and reassigned to administrative duties while the district attorney's office looks into the incident. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Kendra Rankin, the author of Anti-Racism. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, The Soul Connection. Tonight's weather, a 100% chance of rain, down to a low 46 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, that rain continues and we're up to a high of 51. Today in history, on this date in 1968, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned an Arkansas law that banned the teaching of evolution in public schools. The quote of the day is from President-elect Joe Biden. The purpose of our politics, the work of the nation, isn't to fan the flames of conflict, but to solve problems, to guarantee justice, to give everybody a fair shot, to improve the lives of our people. We may be opponents, but we are not enemies. We are Americans. The comment period's now extended for Oregon State University's proposal to manage the Elliott State Forest in southwest Oregon. The original public comment deadline was tomorrow, but state officials decided to extend it to 5 p.m. on November 29th. The university hopes to manage the more than 80,000 acres of the Coos Bay State Parcel as a research forest. The State Land Board plans to review the proposal on December 8th. For more insight on the issue, we talk to Dr. Natalie Paravicini with the Oregon Green Party.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Elliott Forest issue that you mentioned earlier and your view on OSU's proposed use of those lands and your perspective on that issue?
The problem is that the Forestry Department of OSU is heavily financed and influenced by timber industry. And basically what they define as a working forest, like as a reserve working forest, is basically what the timber industry is doing, allowing for only very small diameter woods and small diameter. What it does is that it really promotes monoculture, the cutting of trees and then just replanting up to a certain diameter, and also spraying of the areas. And the problem with the Elliott Forest is that it is one of the only continuous old growth. And so trying to thin out and do this excessive thinning where you destroy old growth and large trees and old growth, it really destroys the entire ecosystem.
This is Anna Fox reporting for KBOO.
And if you want to comment on the proposal for OSU to manage the Elliott State Forest, you can go online to www.oregon.gov and submit your thoughts by November 29th. There are only 158 western wolves left in Oregon. Environmentalists say they're a key species whose presence helps to regulate deer and elk and improves the health of the ecosystem. As Eric Galatis reports, now some groups are challenging the delisting of the wolves from protection, claiming a lack of scientific evidence.
Western wolf advocates filed official notice of their intent to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over its decision to strip gray wolves of federal protections. Kelly Noakes with the Western Environmental Law Center says wolves do not even inhabit 20% of their historic range, which is not true recovery under the Endangered Species Act and a clear violation of the law.
The howl of the wolf remains missing from key wild suitable habitat, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's decision to delist wolves nationwide is premature, and it's plainly not based in science nor the law.
The notice of intent starts a 60-day clock, and if U.S. Fish and Wildlife doesn't address concerns raised, Noakes says the groups will file suit in federal court. The agency claims the gray wolf has exceeded all conservation goals for recovery, pointing to an estimated 4,400 wolves now inhabiting western Great Lakes states. Some hunters and ranchers have also said they need the legal authority to kill wolves who attack their livestock. Noakes says bad weather kills more livestock than wolves, noting that just one cow out of every 44,000 are taken by wolves. The federal government is required by law to restore endangered species to their native habitats, but Noakes says delisting will put management of wolves under states that historically have been hostile to native predators.
For example, in Wyoming, where wolves have been federally delisted since 2017, wolves can be shot on sight across 90% of the state. Wolves across the nation now face a very similar fate.
Noakes argues that U.S. Fish and Wildlife is ignoring science showing that wolves have not fully recovered in key western habitats. Recent estimates show that just 158 wolves remain in Oregon, 108 in Washington State, and 15 in California. Noakes says wolves are essentially extinct in Nevada and Utah, as well as in Colorado, where voters recently approved a measure to begin the process of wolf reintroduction. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
Navajo Nation warns residents about the uncontrollable spread of COVID-19. And the National Native American Veterans Memorial opens to the public. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Department of Health is warning residents of uncontrollable spread of COVID-19 in 34 communities on the reservation. Navajo leaders and health professionals are urging residents to take precautions and stay home. The tribe has been hit hard by COVID-19 and saw the first wave peak in the spring. Strict measures, including mandatory mask orders, curfews, and lockdowns, are credited to numbers dropping in the summer and fall. But as cases start to rise, Navajo leaders and health officials say they're prepared to take extreme action to help prevent the surge from surpassing the first one. Dr. Jill Jim, director of the Navajo Department of Health, during a virtual town hall this week, says many of the cases have been linked to large gatherings and travel off the reservation.
As we were in May, those were at our highest peak in May, and at that time, I mean, what we experienced is a complete shutdown for a number of months, where the tribe shut down government offices and things like that. But living and with COVID-19 has changed, and the perception of how we need to respond has changed. But those were what we experienced, and you never know, we might have to do extreme mitigation measures to ensure that we stop the spread of COVID-19, and that will impact our healthcare system.
As of Wednesday, the total number of positive COVID-19 cases on the Navajo Nation were 12,818. Native veterans were honored Wednesday. Virtual events were streamed online, including a program to mark the completion of the National Native American Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Mel Sheldon, councilman of the Tulalip tribes who served in Vietnam, kicked off the event recognizing veterans for their service.
When I got back from Vietnam, I was very proud to be a veteran. I was a helicopter pilot at 19. We flew in near Cambodia and into Cambodia, and we served as best as we could. And coming home, talking to other veterans, knowing that we had done our job, it was a proud tradition. For a lot of veterans, coming home was not always easy. And it was the powwows, it was the way our tribal communities put their arms around us to make us feel proud, to help us become whole again. As those that were in combat, they were changed in a way that we could at home help them heal, help them recover.
The memorial is on the grounds of the National Museum of the American Indian. It opened to the public on Wednesday and recognizes Native veterans on a national level. Joe Biden is making plans to take over the federal government as president and preparing for his cabinet, even as President Trump fights the election and has not conceded. The Biden-Harris transition team was announced this week and includes Native Americans, Kevin Washburn, Chickasaw, Janie Hipp, Chickasaw, and Chris James, Eastern Band of Cherokee. Washburn's a law professor and dean and is a former federal official. Hipp's a leader in Native American agriculture and has worked in Washington, D.C. James has held positions in the federal government and leads a national Native economic development organization. Biden-Harris transition teams will review agencies to help with the smooth transfer of power. Tribal leaders and directors of national Native organizations across the country are recognizing the Biden-Harris projected win and are prepared to move forward with the next administration. This week, the Alaska Federation of Natives released a statement of congratulations and said the AFN looks forward to working with the teams and seeing the new administration's initiatives next year. The National Congress of American Indians, in a statement Saturday, said it looks forward to working with the team to ensure Indian country priorities are addressed.
Executives of pharmaceutical giant Pfizer faced scrutiny over possible insider trading this week. This comes after they sold millions of dollars worth of stock the same day they announced a new vaccine for COVID-19. CEO Albert Bourla sold more than 60% of his stock in the company Monday, making nearly $5.6 million. Also selling more than $1 million of shares Monday was Pfizer Executive Vice President Sally Sussman. Both made the trades following a securities and exchange rule that allows major shareholders to make predetermined trades of fixed amounts of stock once it hits a certain price. Sussman's sale was pre-authorized a year ago. According to Pfizer, Bourla made his plans through a third party in August. Daniel Taylor with the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania tells NPR he's been following trading related to the coronavirus this past year. He calls the deal, quote, very suspicious, pointing to a Pfizer press release from August announcing the company and its German partner were moving toward a regulatory review for their promising vaccine by October. That press release was dated August 20th, just a day after CEO Albert Bourla's stock sale was arranged. The company's stock rose as much as 15% on Monday following the announcement that its vaccine was 90% effective in late-stage trials. Since then, the price has dropped and remained about a dollar above last Friday's closing. A recent Forbes article suggests the stock isn't expected to remain elevated due to the vaccine's inconvenient storage requirements, competition, and profit sharing between co-developers. Pfizer plans to file for emergency authorization of the vaccine with the FDA this month, setting the stage for distribution. On Monday, Dr. Anthony Fauci called the initial results, quote, just extraordinary, saying the vaccine is a game changer for COVID response. In a recent American Psychological Association poll, 8 in 10 adults said the coronavirus pandemic is a significant source of stress in their lives. As Mike Moen reports, in stressful times, our mental and physical health need attention.
Even with the election season mostly in the rearview mirror, Iowa is still dealing with the COVID-19 surge. A local mental health expert says people are bound to feel more stressed these days and warns that not addressing it could create physical health problems. Iowa psychologist Dr. Warren Phillips says anecdotally, providers across the state have seen an increase in people reaching out for help. He says the effect has come in waves, starting with panic, then depression and isolation, and eventually more anger. Phillips says if these symptoms develop into chronic stressors, they can eventually take a toll on a person's physical health.
It can contribute to high blood pressure, overeating, smoking, physical inactivity. It becomes a risk factor for heart disease.
Phillips says one way to counteract stress is meditation, even if it's informal. He also suggests regular exercise, a simple walk, maybe combined with a phone chat with a loved one. The American Heart Association says nationally, 1 in 3 Americans reports being worried or depressed, and more than half of U.S. adults say COVID-19 has negatively impacted their mental well-being. Phillips says if symptoms linger to the point where they affect daily routines, that would be a good point to seek professional help. He says in Iowa, that isn't always easy because of provider shortages in rural areas.
We find folks in our rural communities are at increased risk of a variety of stress-related negative outcomes.
Phillips says that shouldn't deter anyone from seeking help, and telecounseling can be beneficial in those situations. The Iowa Psychological Association can help people find the closest provider. Meanwhile, the Heart Association has a list of tips for coping with stress on its website. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 12, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Samantha Law, Michelle Coppola, and Ken Jones. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Thank you so much for joining us for the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
With Joe Biden's victory in last Tuesday's election, a new administration takes charge in January, and they'll be facing some pretty big challenges. Along with COVID-19, climate change, and the battered economy, the unmasking and encouragement of racism and white supremacy over the past 4 years tops the list. Our in-depth guest today, Kenria Rankin, has been an important voice in that struggle as an author, journalist, editor, and speaker. Kenria co-authored How We Fight White Supremacy, a field guide to Black resistance, published last year. Her new book is Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas, available now from Seattle's Sasquatch Books. Kenria also co-hosts the Turn On podcast, which focuses on literary erotica created by and for Black women and the LGBTQ community. And she'll be moderating a panel at this year's Portland Book Festival. The session, titled No Justice, No Peace, takes place this Saturday, November 14th, and features young adult novelist Kim Johnson and Francisco X. Stork. Kenria, thanks for joining us today from your home in Washington, D.C.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Kenria, let's get right to the newest book, Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas. It's a beautifully designed work. You've called it somewhat of a coffee table book, though a little smaller.
Yeah.
And it features over 100 quotes from anti-racist leaders, past and present. In the introduction, which really struck me, this analogy, a ladder analogy, you use to depict white supremacy, which you define as a political, social, and economic system that thrives on the subjugation of people who have not been let into whiteness. Can you describe that ladder for us?
Sure. So, as you said, I like to use that analogy because I think it really helps people to get an image of in their mind of what white supremacy is. So what I tell folks is to close your eyes and envision a ladder. It's sturdy, it's stable, it's firmly rooted into the ground. And on the very top rung sits white, cisgender, heterosexual, Christian, wealthy, educated, able-bodied man. And every other person in our society gets slotted in somewhere below him based on the oppression that's been heaped on their shoulders. And those oppressors can include racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, transphobia, ableism, all the isms and the obias that you can think of that push us closer down to the ground. And I like to use this because I think it can really help people understand the ways that the things that are heaped on us determine our place and our value within the society that we're operating in.
You also mentioned that there's a toxic smog, a very effective analogy, that envelops the ladder. and it affects everyone. So those white, Christian, middle-aged, able folks who are at the top of the ladder might think that it doesn't affect them. But you make a strong point that they're still being poisoned by the very same system that's hurting everyone else below those top rungs. How does white supremacy poison even those at the top of the ladder?
Well, I think that, you know, it doesn't take much longer, much more than to look at the celebrations that we had in the street over the weekend to see the ways that people have been pushing up against it and were happy to be freed from the ways that it impacts their lives, right? When you have someone who subscribes to white supremacy and who uses it in order to shore up their own power, the policies that they make influence the ways that we live, right? Even folks who are at the closer end of the top of that ladder can still feel negative effects when, you know, policies are not put into place to keep them safe during a pandemic, for instance, right? You know, there are folks who may check all of these boxes except for the fact that they are not wealthy, and they may vote for candidates who have policies that ultimately don't actually serve them, but because they led with their whiteness and because they wanted to prop up this system which has privileged them for so long, it can be easy to look past the ways that it hurts you economically in the long run, because it can be really attractive to see someone who feels the same ways that you do, who centers the issues that seems to be most important to you, even if they're not necessarily digging into the things that ultimately underpin the daily ongoings of your life, like not having stimulus checks that allow people to be able to stay home and stay safe in, you know, difficult times.
What struck me, and I liked a lot, was it's not just selfish and cruel, white supremacy, but it's also self-destructive for even those people at the top. Now, you include this quote from Angela Davis in the book: "In a racist society, it's not enough to be non-racist. We must be anti-racist." And of course, the book is titled Anti-Racism and not Non-Racism. Can you talk about the difference between the two?
Sure. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, that ladder that we're talking about of white supremacy, it's propped up by a few things, and those include, you know, racism, classism, and whatnot. And so one thing I like to make clear is that white supremacy doesn't act on its own. It's got all these other things that prop it up, and racism is just one of them. And so being anti-racist is just one of the ways that we can help to battle white supremacy. And being anti-racist simply means being actively working against the system of that privileges racism. So that doesn't mean saying that you're colorblind. It doesn't mean, you know, a lot of the things that people do that kind of dance around the issue. It means that you are taking action each and every day to make sure that you are operating in a way that dismantles that part of the system.
Yeah, and there's this poem in there from Nayira Wahid: "Never trust anyone who says they do not see color. This means to them you are invisible." And throughout the book, you emphasize the importance of recognizing and accepting our differences, not just race, but a number of things. If somebody is disabled or a different religion, a different sexual orientation, and not overlooking and homogenizing them, which is a tendency in the U.S. And you have another quote from Pastor Michael McBride: "Liberation is where a difference is seen as an asset and not a liability." Why is that a more effective way and probably a necessary way to combat racism rather than just this common practice of saying, "Hey, I don't see color, we're all the same here in the U.S.?
Well, because ultimately, you know, and the quote that you read previously really gets at it. At the point that you say that you don't see color, that you are colorblind, what you're ultimately saying is that you don't see me. And it's impossible for you to dismantle a system that you can't even acknowledge exists. And how can you help people when you can't acknowledge that you can see them? You know, people ask me all the time, you know, what is it that they think that they should do? And I think, you know, I start there. Like, don't call yourself colorblind. You should be working toward being anti-racist. Another thing is, you know, I tell folks not to ask Black and other people of color to do emotional or other labor for them. a lot of, you know, what it means to be anti-racist is to do research and find out information for yourself and to not expect other people to do the work for you, which very often is labor that is placed upon the backs of Black folks. Also, it's important to be courageous and hold yourself and the white people around you to be accountable for the ways that they're holding up the system of white supremacy.
That's actually a lot of good advice, but the book itself is kind of more educational and mm-hmm. inspirational than prescriptive. And I have a quote in your previous book, How We Fight White Supremacy. You took a similar tack. And in your introduction to that book, you wrote, "Although this book is not prescriptive, if we had a magic button we could press to end this nightmare, we would have leaned on it long ago." And I used it instead of some words.
Yeah. I was wondering what you're going to do there.
I know. Well, instead of the beep, I thought I would just kind of reword just slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And the book you called it is thoughtful and hopeful and bursting with agency. I would say the same thing about anti-racism. So that's mm-hmm. very much by design, not taking that prescriptive mm-hmm. approach.
Absolutely. You know, I think this book really functions in a couple of ways. One, I think it's an entry or 101 to the concept of anti-racism that we've been talking about. And then I also think it works really well as a resource. You know, my daughter was recently studying her line. She's doing this virtual play at school because we're, you know, still doing remote learning. And Cesar Chavez was one of the leads in the play. And she came to me and she asked me a bit about him. And I was really excited that I could pick up the book and flip to the page with his, you know, words and his photo, and then also read the short bio that I wrote about him. And that's really how I hope that it functions for a lot of people. You know, I hope that folks can use it as a resource, but also move beyond that and in reading it, either see themselves on the page as they currently are or see the person that they want to be, and that it helps them find their own ways to be actively anti-racist every single day.
We mentioned in the intro, too, that you'll be moderating a session called No Justice, No Peace at the Portland Book Festival. This year, the festival is entirely online and to take place over 2 weeks instead of one big day, as it has previously because of the pandemic. The session you'll be moderating features two young adult novelists, Kim Johnson and Francisco X. Stork, and that will be live streamed this Saturday, the 14th. Can you give us a little preview of the session, how it came together, and tell us a little bit about Kim and Francisco?
Well, sure. It came together really because my publisher, Sashquatch Books, is based in the Northwest.
Yes, Seattle.
And, they're in Seattle. And, you know, they like to always send authors, and we felt that this was a wonderful time to really lift up, you know, not only the work that's in anti-racism, but other YA works. And I was just really pleased to be put together with Kim and Francisco to be able to do this this panel. I haven't had the pleasure of meeting them yet, and I'm very excited to, but I have been reading their books and am really looking forward to talking to them about the themes that really cross all three books, which, you know, focus on the issues of racial justice and immigration and the ways that those things intersect.
I wish we could speak more. I've got so many questions here. But the last one is, where can listeners find out more about anti-racism, your newest book, and all your work and upcoming events?
Sure. So online, I'm at kenria.com, which is KENRYA.com. And since my parents are so creative and gave me a name that no one else really has, I'm at Kenria on all the social media. So on Twitter and on IG, I am there heavy. So I'd love to see you all there.
We've been talking with Kenria Rankin, author of the new book, Anti-Racism, Powerful Voices, Inspiring Ideas from Seattle Sasquatch Books. Kenria will be moderating a Portland Book Festival panel, No Justice, No Peace, featuring young adult novelist Kim Johnson and Francisco X. Stork. The event will be live streamed this Saturday, November 14th at 2:30 p.m. Pacific Time. You can find out more online at pdxbookfest.org, and you can find out more about anti-racism, Kenria's new book, and all her work online at kenria.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth. ¶¶
think since the movies Free Willy and Blackfish that keeping whales in captivity to perform for humans wouldn't really be an issue anymore. But unfortunately, that's not the case. One of those orcas is Lolita, who has been living isolated in a small tank at the Miami Seaquarium for over 50 years. For years now, the Lummi Nation in Washington State has been joined by conservation and animal welfare groups in an effort to free Lolita, who is also known as Tokite, or by her Lummi name, Skalichak Tinot. One of those organizations is the Earth Law Center, and I spoke with Michelle Bender, Ocean Rights Manager for ELC, about where that fight now stands. Michelle, can you tell us more about how Lolita was captured 50 years ago?
Yeah, so Lolita, as you noted, it is her stage name. Others have known her throughout the years by Tokite, and then most recently is Skalichak Tinot from the Lummi Nation. So she was actually captured 50 years ago, August 8, 1970, with approximately 79-80 other orcas in the area of Penn Cove, Washington. My understanding of this capture is that they use tactics like bomb droppings and aircrafts, you know, loud noises from boats to really drive the orcas into this shallow cove so that they could be captured. And Skalichak Tinot was one of those captured. She was believed to be about 3 or 4 years old at the time and was then sold to the Miami Sea Aquarium about a month later. When she arrived on September 24th of that same year. And she's now the last survivor of the southern residents that were captured that day.
They captured 79 to 80 whales that day. They didn't just take a few out of that pod.
Yeah, it was one of the largest single day captures in history.
So what is her life like at the Miami Seaquarium?
Well, she spent, you know, about 50 years in what you could equate to a prison. You know, it's the smallest orca tank in the world. The metrics of her tank, it's 80 feet long, 35 feet wide, and 20 feet deep. Putting that in perspective, Skalichak Tinot herself is 22 feet long.
Yeah, she's longer than her tank is deep.
Yeah, exactly. So she can't even dive fully. And as we know, wild orcas, you know, they actually swim upwards of 40 miles a day and dive to depths of, you know, 100 to 500 feet just to find food. So that is incredibly limiting. And before the pandemic, I believe she was performing at least 2 shows a day. You know, with that small of a tank, she's been vulnerable to the hot sun, hurricane seasons.
And of course, she's isolated most of the time, yes?
Yeah, I mean, she did have a fellow orca with her, Hugo, for about 10 years. He died in 1980, and some scientists, vets, experts believe that he died from a brain aneurysm that was actually the result of self-inflicted harm by banging his head against the wall. You know, an orca's brain is 2.5 times on average the size of a human brain. So you can only imagine the psychological stress that must incur from that much solitude and confinement.
So, you know, ELC, as I mentioned earlier, is joining along with the Lummi Nation in Bellingham, Washington area, near where Lolita was captured, and they're really kind of leading this fight. Why is freeing her so important to the Lummi Nation?
Well, the essence of their way of knowing and doing, and I would say Indigenous peoples in general, is really based on this deep respect for nature, all species, and ecosystems. You know, specifically, they consider orcas or Quetzalcoatl as their relations underwater. So they consider orcas as their family and their kin, you know, their aunt, their sister. And, you know, particularly we're partnering with two members of the Lummi Nation, Ellie and Raynell, also known by Tomas and Skila Hele. And they believe they've been called on to bring her home. You know, orcas, salmon, the Salish Sea, it's all a deep part of their existence, their culture, their spiritual, you know, practices. And so they believe that the Salish Sea and themselves as a nation cannot be whole or heal without her home.
So it's an extremely important fight. This is a matter of family for them.
Yeah.
So how long has the effort to free her been going on, and when did your organization become involved in the fight?
Oh gosh, it's been going on for decades.
Really?
It's been led by organizations like PETA, Orca Network, Animal Legal Defense Fund. Throughout the years, they've launched over 6 legal actions to try to release her. These have been largely under, you know, the Endangered Species Act or Animal Welfare Act, you know, trying to find some ways to encourage her release. And, you know, we didn't come into this until this year, actually, in June, when we started partnering with Ellie and Raynell, even though they began their own personal campaign, like I said before. And we really just felt we had a, you know, this moral and ethical obligation to do so.
It's really just a heartbreaking situation. And what I don't understand is, aside from the fact that she's a moneymaker, or at least was before COVID closed the parks, what reasons is this aquarium giving for not releasing Lolita? I mean, wouldn't it be a great public relations win for them? Why won't they do this?
Yeah, I mean, many of the responses I have seen from the aquarium when they've been reached out to for media, for example, you know, throughout the years, it's along the lines of, we believe she's well cared for, she's loved here, we know how to take care of her, and that moving her, they believe, would only harm her. But, you know, as I noted, we know that orcas are sentient beings with emotions, culture, and we also know that other relocations have been successful. I know we'll speak more to that in a little bit, but the world in general, people are raising awareness to try to end this captive industry. So I do think that this would be a great public relations win for them, you know, not only because of this larger movement that's occurring with animal rights, but because it would also be about honoring and respecting the rights of the Lummi Nation and Indigenous rights.
We do want to circle back a little bit to what you were mentioning about they feel like she might not thrive in the wild. And a lot of people feel that Keiko, when he was released all those years ago, didn't thrive when he was released in Iceland. Although a lot of organizations involved consider his release a success because, hey, he got 5 years of relative freedom and, you know, more of a natural life than he'd ever had. One of the problems I understood there was that because he'd been captured so young and he'd lived so much of his life in captivity, he really couldn't break the need for human contact. So my questions here are, is there concern that this might be the case for Lolita since she's a lot older than Keiko was and has been in captivity longer? And what's the plan to keep her healthy and make the release successful should the aquarium finally agree to release her?
I mean, certainly it is a concern, and I'll just start by saying I'm not an expert on the logistics.
Right. Yeah.
I do know, just because of the broader campaign, that there are experts that are collaborating on developing an operational plan in anticipation of the Seaquarium agreeing to release. And this is actually something that groups have been thinking about for years. And, you know, when you're looking at the development of this plan, we're bringing in experts that have specialized experience in marine mammal rescue, transport, research, rehabilitation, but also those that have expertise in pathology and disease transfer, for example, because you want to make sure you have all the steps necessary are covered. And you want to ensure that we're bringing Skelly Toxinet home in a safe and responsible manner. So this includes pre-transport evaluation, you know, making sure she is actually okay and healthy to transport with the necessary tests and whatnot, you know, husbandry, conditioning her for the move. And then, you know, looking at what needs to be done to ensure that she's taken care of when she's on an on-site sanctuary here in the Sailor Sea, what sort of medical long-term enrichment she might need. You know, obviously the long-term goal is to see her, you know, swimming freely, but that can only happen if it's within her best interest, just like it was with Kaiko's.
Yeah. And she's 50 now. How long do orcas naturally live in the wild?
Well, you know, there are some a part of the pod right now that are believed to be over 80. And one of those is actually, they're not sure, but it could be her mom.
Wow. So there's a chance she could have 30 more years of a happy, at least somewhat normal life were she returned to the Lummi Nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So do you have any idea how many orcas still live in captivity around the world? Again, I know you're not an expert on all things orca, but I know there's one that they're also campaigning to release up in Canada, at the Canadian Marine Land. Are they still being actively stolen from the wild for entertainment purposes, or are they protected in most places? What's the status now?
There's approximately 59 orcas left in captivity in about 7 countries and until now. And only about 19 of those have happened since 2002. So just, you know, those numbers show that there has been a decline. And, you know, as I noted earlier, there's certainly a movement away from this, from not only capturing, but allowing breeding programs and amusement shows to continue. So just in, you know, the U.S., California passed the Orca Protection Act in 2017, and that bans holding orcas in activity for entertainment purposes and captive breeding programs. And then we're also seeing entire countries, such as Costa Rica, Chile, Switzerland, India, New Zealand.
France just did it as well.
Yeah. Just within the last week. They're passing these laws, banning the practices, or even going further and passing laws that recognize that animals are sentient beings with rights, like they did in New Zealand. So this is just amazing to see.
It really is amazing. So what I want to know is, with regard to Tokite, with regard to her, what can people do if they want to get involved in the fight to help free her or other captive whales around the world?
Yeah, more broadly, you know, businesses listen to consumers and demand. So the public can take action by not supporting places that have cetaceans on display, taking that action with the money you choose to spend or not to spend, right?
Right.
And particularly for our next steps. So we're currently exploring, you know, all legal pathways to encourage her release, but we're also building this public awareness and support campaign. So for those wanting to get involved, you know, first we have this petition on change.org. And we're asking people to please sign and share. You know, this is specific to not only Scali Tactonet's rights, but Indigenous rights, this idea of family and kinship. We also have a solidarity letter that's specifically for Indigenous leaders to support this campaign. So we've had Indigenous leaders from the Maori tribe in New Zealand, Cowichan tribe in Canada, the Nez Perce in Idaho, and the Ponca Nation in Oklahoma. They've all signed on in support of publicly honoring this campaign and wanting to see, you know, the Lummi Nation bring her home. You know, I would just say finally, you know, Earth Law Center, we're always accepting volunteers. So we're always happy to take any, you know, help that you feel like you can give. You know, you don't need a certain type of expertise. And then, you know, if you feel like you don't have the time, of course, you can always donate as well to help support this campaign.
If you'd like to learn more about Lolita's situation and how you can help in the efforts to free her, there's several places you can go. One is earthlawcenter.org. The other is the Lummi Nation website called sacredsea.org. Lolita, or Tokite, also has a Facebook page under Free Lolita the Orca. I'm Michelle Coppola for KBOO News.
Tell me, baby. listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is excited to be a part of the Willamette Week Give Guide this year. When you support KBOO through Give Guide, not only does it support your favorite community radio station, it also gives a little back to you in return. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get full access to hundreds of local coupons in the Chinook Book app, plus a few other goodies, available while supplies last. So donate to KBOO on Give Guide today at kboo.fm/give. Thanks.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. Stick with us as we play you music, throwback interviews, and more. Stay safe, wash your hands, wear a